Matt Polka here with another edition of ACA's Cable Talk. I'm here today with Bridget Baker of Baker Media, but we're coming to you from the show floor of the 13th annual ACA NCTC Independent Show in Anaheim, California. So let's get ready for Cable Talk. Welcome back, everyone, for another edition of Cable Talk, ACA's podcast covering issues in our industry of interest to our members. And today I'm very, very pleased to be with Bridget Baker of Baker Media, a good friend of ACA. Bridget has spoken at our summit before. She's been part of our events and a terrific supporter of our members. So, Bridget, glad to have you with us here in Anaheim, your hometown.
I'm so happy to be here, and I'm thrilled you're in Southern California, because I think the last time you were here was in 2013.
It was a long time ago, yes indeed.
So when I heard you were coming back right into my backyard, I said, I have to get there. And, you know, Matt, I have to say congratulations, because this show is...
Oh, my goodness, yes.
Really, honestly, I think it's getting bigger, maybe. I know there's a lot of consolidation, but I mean in sort of the psyche of a
yes.
lot of people in the industry, because
Indeed.
Now there is no longer an NCTA national show. And a lot of people, I think, miss that gathering. So this is becoming more...
And we're here in Anaheim, the site of the Western show for
exactly.
so many years. So this is a real... It's really kind of old home week in many ways, but it also ties in with what we've been trying to do here as part of the independent show since we put this together in 2006, is to create that family event. So it kind of harkens back to the old days of
yes.
cable, which is so cool.
I agree. It's
so
really fun.
Great to have you here today.
Thank
and we're
you.
Just really, really thrilled. So let's just start off with a bit of your background.
I can go back kind of far, so maybe I won't
go ahead.
Back
That's
all
good.
The way. But,
a lot of perspective.
It's actually only a couple of stops, in a way, when you think about it. I, right out of college, went to work for my U.S. senator from Alaska, which mm-hmm. is my home state. The late Senator Ted Stevens, and spent 4 years on his personal staff, which was just an amazing experience.
Oh, he was a terrific guy. We miss him so much
well,
in D.C.
I mean, really.
Really
truly,
do.
He certainly understood telecom to his
yep.
bones, because Alaska is a state, as you know.
Absolutely.
That does not have telephone poles strung across the entire state.
Mm-hmm.
What we used to call the rural Alaska telecom system, rats, we used, you know, was
yeah.
phone service was satellite delivered.
Sure.
So I grew up in a very different environment in terms of television and mm-hmm. any of these things. And I didn't go to Washington, D.C. with the idea of telecom, because I had not been exposed to so many of these issues. I didn't have a TV. I mean, I grew up, we had a television, but shows were bicycled up
exactly.
on a ferry.
Right.
There was not an ABC, NBC, CBS in little Juneau, Alaska. So it wasn't a dominant force in anyone's life.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to Washington because I studied political science. They called it political studies in college. And I had been a high school intern for Senator Stevens.
Okay.
And I had done that for a summer before starting college and really wanted to go back. And Alaska was a bit on fire at the time in terms of very hot issues. Mm. So much of the federal government touches Alaska in terms of lands issues, Native American, Alaska Native issues,
Indeed.
Oil and gas, all the natural resources.
Sure.
It was
sure.
very, very exciting. Stevens was
sure,
extremely
the seas
senior.
And commerce
yes,
and fishing.
All
and,
of it.
Yep.
Big deal. So by the time I was sort of ending my time there, I had gone to graduate school at night at George Washington University, and my undergrad was at Pitzer College, not far from here at the Claremont Colleges,
sure.
and I knew I wanted to work in the private sector, and I wasn't quite ready to go back to Alaska, and I got an opportunity. I was sort of doing these informational interviews around Washington and talking to some companies that today, Gannett, for instance,
right.
MCI, the
yep.
old, you know, they
sure,
were there.
Of course.
And of course, I went to see AT&T, who mm-hmm. even back then was a force to be reckoned with and on telecom
Always.
Issues. And I visited these companies, and I would be escorted into the top floor where I say the air is thin and the carpets are thick. And it's quiet. And I was coming out of a very hustle-bustle Capitol Hill office. And I was 25 or 26 years old, and I thought, I can't work in this environment.
Mm-hmm.
This is, I don't think so. About that time, I had a girlfriend who was working retail in a department store that does not exist in D.C. anymore. And she is the one who really got me started on my cable career unknowingly. Because she had gotten an old VHS tape for a company that today is QVC.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
But it was the Fashion Channel.
Yes.
And that
yes.
was my very first stop at
How
cable.
About that?
And that's what got me to California, because they were starting, not actually, Matt, not far from here, in Carson, California.
Yes,
they had an
not
enormous
far away. Right.
facility.
The facility there, right.
And TCI ended up buying the assets of this company. They rolled it into another shopping service called Cable Value Network out of Minneapolis,
yes,
CBN.
Sure, sure.
That was acquired by QVC.
Yep.
But there were some really pioneering aspects of that venture, which was completely started by an entrepreneur in the retail business. And the first and the most distinguishing characteristic is no one had tried to sell clothes on television before.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
that is what lured people into this concept. It was high risk. But today, I mean, look at it. Well, today we can't,
yeah.
because we can skip cable altogether
right.
and go to Amazon and other things. But that was really, and I just by then had not really had a private sector experience, but that is when I met some of the people that are your members today that are walking this floor. So 18 months into this venture with the Fashion Channel, and it was being acquired. I was the last employee on the books. I was wrapping up all of the contracts. I was sending them to Denver. I was packing up stuff. It was a little eerie, frankly, at the time, because it was such a big facility and no one else was in there. But I sort of decided, that's it. Okay, I tried the private sector. I'm going running back to Washington, D.C. I need air cover. I'm going back to Stephen's office. I'll go finish my MBA, which I never finished. And that's it. And it was in the process of stopping in Alaska first, do a little salmon fishing with my family, that I got this call out of the blue sky. And it was from Tom Rogers, who was the first, and his lieutenant at the time. He was the first president of NBC Cable and New Business Development. And Tom and I did not know each other, but he had been running around the nation visiting with MSOs and talking about the idea that NBC was going to, quote, get into the cable business. And he would meet with people, all people whose names you know. I mean, ranging from Monty Rifkin to Alan Harmon to all the pioneers, all the original guys. And apparently, my name came up when he would talk about, you know, I need to get some people on the ground, and he heard my name. And so he tracked me down and said, and then when he learned I'd worked on Capitol Hill, he famously, I mean, told me that that's all he needed to know, because he knew I had learned one thing and one thing only, which was never to take no for an answer. That was his assessment of my time with Stevens, which was probably true. And that's, it was good advice. And I committed to Tom Rogers for 90 days in 1988. And I literally was the last person standing from the original. By the time that Comcast acquired us and I stayed with Steve Burke and, you know, the team there, Brian Roberts, and for 2 years after they arrived, I was literally the last person from the original crew.
So we're going to talk about more of your experience at NBC, particularly from the development of content.
Yes.
But tell us a little bit about Baker Media today, what you're doing.
Well, so when I stepped out of Comcast, it was in 2013, and I was on two industry boards at the time. Right away, I started getting calls. I had never been a consultant. I had spent 23 years inside the company. And it was one of these experiences of, oh, Bridget, you don't know what you have no idea. You've thrown away more information in your two decades at NBC than most people even, you know. You've got to come help us strategize this. You've got to come. So I was getting calls, and I kind of had never thought, oh, I'll build a big consulting practice. But I did take on two big clients pretty much right away. One was the Tennis Channel, Ken Solomon and the Tennis Channel. And actually, the other one was Melinda Whitmer, was the chief programming acquisition executive at Time Warner Cable at the time with Rob Marcus. And they needed some help out here with the Dodgers Network. So I went to work right away, and for about the next year and a half, I did really those two projects.
Tell us a little bit about just the nature of the formation of cable content from a linear perspective, and really how that started to change into more of the consolidated content we know today.
I mark a lot of this in my mind to the early 1990s, and in my mind, the two pivotal developments for my company at the time was our success in convincing GE to spend $155 million buying the bankrupt assets of FNN, the Financial News Network, which was 1991. And the second was the development of the regulation to allow broadcasters to negotiate for the consent of their signals. And before we knew it, we had this retransmission legislation passing. And suddenly, we had an asset called Channel 4 in our O&O markets that allowed us another opportunity to sit down with cable operators who overlapped in those markets. And that marks the moment for me. With the advent of retransmission consent, they got the ability to put value against the broadcasters. And years later, may he rest in peace, Fred Dressler said to me, the longtime executive at Time Warner, that he thought in his mind the biggest mistake the cable industry made was not just paying the fees for the signal.
At the beginning.
At the very beginning. Because what happened is these content creation companies create billion-dollar assets, multi-billion-dollar assets, on the backs of the cable operators. Simply put, right? ESPN was simply ESPN. But on the back of retransmission consent, it became ESPN 15. And I'm talking Disney, obviously. For NBC, right, it was maybe just pay for Channel 4. And by the way, only 11 or 13 markets where we owned a station. So it would have been pay for Channel 4 in Chicago, Miami, D.C., New York, L.A., San Francisco, Charlotte, full stop. And instead, we created MSNBC.
It led to the concept, because of these things you're talking about, where the companies that owned the content realized it was to their benefit to become bigger, because now you can have more channels with which you can leverage for a carriage.
So there was a gap in time there where additional content was very favorable, because the cable operators said, we need things to put on our channels. And here we were all in the business of creating content. So there was a time when they were asking for more. And then eventually there became also this, you could call it the third wave, if you say 330 to 750, Megs, and then remember the hits headed in the sky?
I sure do.
The
sure.
Digital, that became another. That's when companies like Discovery,
yes,
as an example, a company that did not have a broadcast asset, so they had never played the game of retransmission consent, developed the Science Channel,
yes,
and Discovery Kids Network. All those
other
things were digital,
right,
content channels to put in those mega, in those.
So let me ask you this, though. Where is this likely to lead with these larger companies that continue to merge to create even a bigger bundle? At the same time, what consumers want is more choice over the top. I mean, where do we see this tension leading us to?
You hit on something else, which is the shift in, some might say and will say, quality from the early Discovery days to maybe what today is, or the earliest Discovery days and maybe what Curiosity Stream is. And the phenomenon that happened in those 20 years, if let's just call it 20 years, is once highly penetrated networks like Discovery, CNBC was one, ESPN, obviously, when your growth to your maximum subscribers was achieved, the only other way outside of negotiating a new contract with a distributor, but advertising was the only way to then get increased revenue. So your comment about the commercialization and how going after the ratings became a thing really did happen. And we can go across the board and talk about A&E or Discovery or the Learning Channel. Or there's many of these that I think you would comment on. They had a vision in the beginning that changed, and they went after commercial advertising. So that leads to what I think is also driving today's consumer. Before we talk about demographics or age or anything, it is that these streaming services are commercial free. And this is what no one ever wanted to talk about. When I first got into the industry, of course, HBO had already been around for, my God, 15 years. If they started in 74, I mean, they had been around almost 15 years. And back then, they were fights and, you know, the other stuff and, you know, whatever Cinemax had on after hours that always was talked about. But the point is, I always believed people paid for commercial free. They did not want to watch commercials. And that's the phenomenon in part about Netflix, is you get this stuff without the ads. And, you know, this is just very interesting. I mean, Hulu is another story to tell
started. Tell us a little bit about that, because at NBC you actually were involved in the creation of Hulu, you know, which now is really kind of competitor to Amazon Prime and Netflix, and it's really one of the three major commercial over-the-top services. So, you know, and again, it's something that's partially owned by, you know, the big content providers. So, and that which is still what makes it so interesting, because they control the bundle, but they also want to sell it over the top. And our members sometimes say, well, wait a minute, I sort of get it both ways.
And they would be accurate in saying that. And no one can see me nodding, but I'm nodding big nods to you. Most of the thinking that drove the ideation of Hulu was, okay, we'll build our own legal destination for high quality video content. And the subtext of that direction was so that someone else does not do it. Right? It was a piracy focus. Let me say it another way. It was an anti-piracy focus as much as it was anything else. And again, context, 2005. We closed on Universal in 04, late 04. The person, the company, sorry, bidding against us in our bid for Universal was Mr. Brian Roberts at Comcast. So they did not win the bid. We won, and we got the asset. So then, of course, it's my job to go to Philadelphia and sit down with them and talk now about our big film library and all the things we're going to do. We're going to create a new channel called Chiller. We're creating a crime network called Sleuth. Both of these things have now gone through so many iterations. But you know, Steve Burke and Brian Roberts knew very well what was inside the vaults, their word, vaults, at Universal, because they had been bidding on the asset themselves. And they wanted a different game from NBC. They wanted us to sort of open that vault, because their focus in 2005 was very much a competitive focus against satellite. And their strategy was to load up their on-demand platform so that they were sticky against a satellite competitor for their customers. And NBC's reaction was, well, no, we just spent $16 billion or something. We're not opening the vault and just handing over this stuff, and I don't think that's happening. Gentlemen. So that was the meeting in June of 05 in Philadelphia that partially planted the seed of what eventually became.
So let me ask you this before we get to your board service with GCI and to talk about a few other things and before we wrap today. Our members today are in the midst of trying to provide the best broadband service that they can for their customers, which sometimes means that they're not necessarily the delivery service. They provide a pipe which a consumer can use to buy other content. But at the same time, as we talked about, they're still dealing with sort of legacy media and legacy media issues. If you were an ISP today dealing with content issues, what would be your strategy?
It's not easy. It's not an easy fix. And I think depending on the community and depending on the plant and what you're doing, I mean, you mentioned GCI, so just quickly, they're the only quad play right now. Maybe not the only, but not the biggest guys haven't figured out the wireless piece. So Ron Duncan, the chairman and founder, is up there competing wireless as well as the other three triple play typical products. So depending on what your company's actually trying to do and what they are doing and in what markets, I think this is a very interesting dilemma. And again, anecdotally, just quickly, I can share a story where once we were in a room in Las Vegas for a senior management meeting at NBC, and under, you know, the cloak of 7 a.m. darkness, Steve Jobs was ushered into our ballroom. It was very secretive. It was during CES. And, you know, of course, historically, Apple does not attend that convention. And, you know, there were maybe 65 of us in that room. And I got a chance to ask a question. And I talked about iTunes and having The Office, as an example, which was a highly rated show at NBC at the time, be available for 99 cents on iTunes. And how in the world could I go negotiate retransmission consent with Time Warner, Comcast, Charter, and Cox if it's up there on the iTunes platform? And Steve Jobs said an interesting thing. He said, you know, no one ever wants to be in the business they're in. And I know the guys at Comcast, they're very smart guys, but it's like when I joined the board of Pixar. They needed to stay in animation. They had a time when they wanted to move out. No. They wanted to move out of animation. No, stay in the business you're in. And you know what? The business the cable guys fundamentally are in is the pipe business. They just don't want to be in the pipe business. And this was in January CES of 2007, maybe. Okay, so we're 11 years beyond that time. But I share that anecdote because I didn't just agree right away. Oh, the cable guy should be in that business, you know. But I thought, interesting. We could all argue that the cable plant has always been about connectivity. Content's what's carried on all the pipes, but it's always been about connectivity. So if you're trying to manage a video business that is at best flat or declining, and your broadband is your most valuable product, unless you're in wireless, like, you know, Ron and GCI and some other things, it's a very, very tough thing to try and manage, because the business for the 5 decades, you know, it's existed, the cable business, or more, we could say 1950 something, so it's been more, has been about way more than connectivity. I mean, it was cable entrepreneurs who started these networks. We've already talked about John Hendricks, Ted Turner at CNN, all of these, BET. I mean, we could go through it all, and they have all been cable entrepreneurs. So it's been about content as much as it's been about connectivity. And trying to figure out how to balance that is really now today the game of the business, because you're balancing the numbers of it. What I think is really tough, and I know you write very eloquently about this, and of course you lobby Capitol Hill amazingly about this issue, but I really believe the broadcasters on the retransmission front, and I've thought this for a long time, and I brought it up, of course, to GCI too, because they're so remote from a big market broadcast station, is the gap there in terms of where we're not seeing eye to eye is so much in these affiliate markets that are number 111, number 79, number, if CBS wants to charge for its O&Os in the big, big markets, that's one thing. But, or NBC or ABC, but they tend to get a flat price, and then they're literally spreading it across the nation. And there needs to be a staggered pricing. There needs to be a D county price, a C county price, a B county price. It's not Los Angeles. Juneau, Alaska is not Los Angeles. And Pittsburgh is not Miami. You know, it just needs to be rationalized. No broadcast. I mean, this is heresy for me to even say anything like this, but I really, I mean, I've seen it from the other side, on the GCI side, of course, and we have 2 broadcast affiliates in Anchorage, so I've seen it on both sides.
I would just say this, that oftentimes I think from a cable operator perspective, what cable operators would say is they're not appreciated in terms of the reach that they do provide in markets that never would receive a broadcast signal.
Correct.
So, it's not a two-way negotiation.
Well,
so,
and people's memories are short, Matt. As you know, everyone likes to forget, or they just simply forget. But I remember when we first got the rights to negotiate retransmission, as we've said, in 1993, it was that whole thing, too, about reverse comp and learning about some of those broadcast issues. That is exactly what CBS, NBC, and ABC were doing when it all started. They were paying for small, independent station owners all across America so that the Today Show could get out to Albuquerque or Lodi, California, or Juneau, Alaska. They paid. And now it's completely flipped.
It's just the reverse.
So the cable operators aren't wrong, and plenty of your members that are here today were old enough to remember. They remember this.
Exactly.
Or they at least remember hearing that it
happened.
They
remember it. They remember it for sure.
We know it was a fact.
Well, Bridget Baker, it has been a delight to have you with us today on Cable Talk. This has been so great to just think back of many of the developments in our industry that bring us to where we are today. I mean, it's still a very, very important business where there is a lot of investment, with broadband providing such a great future. But we have to learn as well from the past. And I think from a content perspective, we're learning that as we figure out our broadband path ahead. So thank you so much for being with us here today, and we'll have to have you back again on Cable Talk.
That would be great. Thank you so much for having me. It was
my
great.
Pleasure. Matt Polka here again, folks, from the American Cable Association. You can find Cable Talk on Apple iTunes, on Podomatic, and at our website at americancable.org/thehub. And don't forget, subscribe, rate, and review.